Okay, good afternoon. This is Richard Clem coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota today. It is Monday, January 18th, 2016, and we are doing conflicts of interest today. I'm doing it as part of a live conference call and also recording it for the podcast. For those of you who are listening on the podcast, during the course of the program, I will give a series of code numbers. So please write those down and email them to me at the end of the program, and I use those to take attendance for the podcast. If you're listening to it live today on January 18th, you don't have to worry about that. But if you're listening to it later, you will need those three code numbers that I will give you during the course of the program. And like I say, today is part one of Conflicts of Interest, and during the next 3 hours, we're going to be discussing the subject of conflicts of interest, which is covered by Rule 1.7 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. And I give this program in various states. Today I have I'm giving it live for Minnesota and Wisconsin. I give the same program in Iowa and Nebraska and some other states. And the rules are the rule is pretty much identical in all of those states. There's a couple of changes in wording in Wisconsin, and Iowa adds one additional provision that we'll talk about. But in general, the rule is basically identical in all of these states. So there should not be too many differences depending on which state you're taking it in. This is kind of a new program for me. Last year, for the past few years, I've been giving an overview of the rules of professional conduct, where we just start at Rule 1.1 and plot our way through to the end and tell you what the actual rules have to say on various subjects. When I get to the subject of conflicts of interest, though, in last year's program, we pretty much glossed over it pretty fast because we will take a look at the actual text of the rule here, but as you will see, it does not give you a whole lot of practical guidance. It pretty much just says that a conflict of interest is something that you're not supposed to engage in, and it doesn't provide too helpful of a definition. So in last year's program, I always warned people that, well, you're really not going to get your money's worth out of the program just by looking at the rule. You probably won't be any smarter on the subject of conflicts of interest than you were previously. So what I did last year was I promised that this year I would put together a separate program where we would go into depth, talk about the subject of conflicts of interest, and I promised that after 3 hours of listening to my program, you would walk away being a world-class expert on the subject of conflicts of interest. Well, I also realized that I can't really honor that promise either, because even in 3 hours of talking as fast as I can, I realized that we're really just still kind of glossing over the high points, and we're not going to go into a lot of depth on any one particular subject. So I think at the end of the program, you probably will have a pretty good idea of the general principles involved in conflicts of interest. But when those actual problems arise in the day-to-day practice of law, well, you'll still decide that you might have to dig into a little bit deeper. What our plan is today, anyway, is to hit those high points so that you'll at least be able to recognize those issues and realize when there might be some of those conflict of interest situations that do come up, so that you'll be able to spot them and hopefully avoid them before they turn into a problem. The other thing I realized when I put this program together was that unlike last year's program where I just blasted through all of the rules, I came away looking like just a world-class expert myself on the subject of attorney ethics because I covered so much material, I was typically forgiven for not going into a lot of depth because there was a lot of material to cover. Well, today I do this program with a little bit of trepidation because we're going to talk about a lot of specific subjects. We're going to talk about, what are your responsibilities as an insurance defense attorney? What are your responsibilities as a criminal defense attorney? And we're going to talk a lot about some specific situations like that. And again, though, just kind of glossing over the details. Well, I do run the real risk here because if you are an insurance defense attorney. Well, you probably know a lot more about that subject material than I do, and you probably know more about it. Well, first of all, if I do make any mistakes, be sure and jump in and let me know what those mistakes are. I'm not going to come off sounding quite as much of an expert on the subject today as perhaps I did last year, because I am addressing specific things that, when we get to that specific area where you practice, well, you might know that that area a lot better than I do. But still, I think the program is helpful because, if you're an insurance defense attorney, well, you probably don't know too much about the rules involving criminal defense work. If you do dabble in those areas at all, you want to have some recognition of what the rules are. So hopefully, in whatever your area of expertise is, we might not provide a lot of helpful information. But on the other hand, in the areas where you do not practice on a regular basis and you need to recognize what those issues are, I think the program will be helpful. Well, like I say, we're going to start, as we did last year, just by looking at the actual text of the rule, of Rule 1.7 of the Wisconsin or Minnesota or Iowa or just about any state's version of the Rules of Professional Conduct, which are all modeled on the ABA Model Code of Professional Conduct. And the subject of conflicts of interest is addressed mostly in Rule 1.7. And there are some other rules that touch on the subject, and we'll talk about those in the program as well. But the general rule covering conflicts of interest I have quoted here on the first page of the materials. And as you can see, it doesn't really provide you a lot of helpful guidance, because all it says is that unless an exception applies, and there are some exceptions we'll talk about, you shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. Well, you already knew that before you took the program, so the rule is not particularly helpful. It just says that you're not supposed to engage in conflicts of interest unless some particular exception applies. It does give you a little bit of help because it does give a definition, at least, of what a conflict of interest is, but as you can see, that's written in pretty general terms also. But it does define a conflict of interest as any of the following. First of all, the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. Well, you already knew that, obviously. You can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant as they are suing one another. You do the direct examination of your client, and then you move to the other counsel table and cross-examine your own client. Obviously, you can't do that. That's the easy case. But kind of the general case, the general definition of conflict of interest is here in paragraph A2. There is a significant risk that the representation of one or more client will be materially limited by your responsibilities to another client, to a former client, to a third party, or some personal interest of your own. So again, that's the general definition that we'll spend the next couple hours trying to figure out exactly what it means, because it's not written, it's written in very general terms. It could mean just about anything. What does it mean that there's a significant risk? And what does it mean that a representation of some client will be materially limited? So like I say, in the next few hours, we'll try to figure out what those words mean by looking at some more specific situations. But that's really what the guidance that the rule gives us. It says don't engage in conflicts of interest, and a conflict of interest just means that your responsibilities are materially limited. There are, as I noted, some exceptions to a conflict of interest, because many but not all conflicts of interest can be consented to. And that's covered in paragraph B of the rule. It says even though there is a conflict of interest, you can still go ahead and represent the client if the client consents, but not just consent. There are some more requirements. First of all, it has to be a case where you reasonably believe that you will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. So in other words, if it's a severe conflict of interest, or I guess I might even say if it's a real conflict of interest, where it's a real problem that, I can't represent both of these people as interests because they really are adverse to one another. Well, if it is one of those situations where it's a serious problem, where it's a conflict of interest that that presents real difficulties, well, then you can't do it, even if the client consents to it. because you have to reasonably believe that despite the conflict of interest, you will be able to competently and diligently represent each of those clients. In addition, the representation cannot be otherwise prohibited by law. And as we will see later in the program, there are some specific situations where there's just a black and white rule that says no, you can never have a, you can never do the representation if it involves this kind of conflict of interest. One example of that is in the criminal defense world. There are some very specific situations where the rules of criminal procedure say, no, you can't represent both of these defendants in this case. So in that case, even though the clients consent to it, it would not be permitted. Another one that we'll talk about in a minute is if you're in Iowa, representing both spouses in a dissolution case. Probably a bad idea in other states, but kind of explicitly prohibited in Iowa. So, you have to reasonably believe that it's going to be okay. It can't be otherwise prohibited by law. And it can't be that extreme case of one client asserting a claim against another client in the same litigation before the same tribunal. So, in other words, that extreme case of you representing both the plaintiff and the defendant, no matter how much your clients consent to it, that's still not permitted. But as long as those provisions are all met, it is okay as long as the client gives informed consent, and that consent has to be in writing. The Wisconsin version of the rule says that the writing has to be signed by the client. So I guess perhaps in Minnesota or Iowa there might be some situation where it's a writing that's not signed by the client, although it would probably be a really good idea in those states to have the client sign that consent as well. But in Wisconsin that's kind of an absolute rule, that it has to be a signed writing. It can't just be an email that you sent to the client saying that we talked about this conflict of interest and you said it was okay. That might be okay in some other states, but not in Wisconsin. So that is the rule as adopted in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Nebraska, and many other states. Because we have some attorneys taking the program from Iowa, I will also note that the Iowa version of the rule adds in another paragraph saying, in no event shall a lawyer represent both parties in a dissolution of marriage proceeding. Now, that's probably a very bad idea to represent both the husband and the wife in a divorce case. Probably a very bad idea in Minnesota and Wisconsin. But theoretically, there might be some situations where we would be permitted. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about some of those where perhaps it might be okay. But in Iowa, it's easy for you. If you're an Iowa attorney, you just can't do it. It's not permitted. You can never do it. Now, like I say, in other states such as Minnesota and Wisconsin, it's probably a bad idea because the two divorcing spouses are sitting there. They came to you jointly and they said, "We want you to prepare the papers for our divorce." Theoretically, in Minnesota you can do that, or in Wisconsin you can do that. In fact, in the Minnesota statutes, probably in the somewhere in the Wisconsin statutes as well, I know in Minnesota there's a section of the Minnesota statutes entitled Joint Petition for Dissolution of Marriage. So the Minnesota statutes presuppose that there will be some cases where the spouses will be filing a joint petition, where they have agreed to settle all their disputes, and then they go to court jointly and file this petition to get their divorce. Presumably, in that joint petition, if they are represented by an attorney, that will be an attorney representing both of them. Now, Probably, like I say, a bad idea for you to get involved in that situation because no matter how amicable they are today and no matter how much they settled their agreements, the fact still remains that they've decided that they can't live with each other anymore, so there must be, a certain level of dispute going on. So, a year from now when one of them decides that they really wanted the silverware and the other spouse got the silverware, there is a very real chance that one of them is going to come along and say, well, my attorney never advised me that I had the, you know, that if I would have asked for the silverware, I would have gotten it. Well, you were not able to say that because you were representing the other spouse as well. So there's a real risk of that happening, and it's very unusual that you would want to do that. Although, like I say, in a minute here, I'll talk about a situation where, well, maybe I would jointly represent both spouses. But it's probably a bad idea. But like I say, if you're in Iowa, you don't have to worry about it at all. The subject of conflicts of interest, it can arise in other situations, but probably the most common situation where you have to worry about violating the rule about conflicts of interest probably comes up in the context of any kind of a joint representation. Now, if you are in-house counsel for one company and you never represent anybody else ever in the practice of law, well, you probably don't have to worry too much about conflicts of interest. Although, like I say, we'll talk about a situation where you might have conflicts of interest even in that situation. But most of us have more than one client, and that's where conflicts of interest arise, and they probably arise most often in the context of you representing two people in the same case. So in other words, any kind of a joint representation. You are representing both plaintiffs or you are representing both defendants. That's a perfectly appropriate, perfectly normal thing for you to do. We do it all the time. But you do have to remember that any time you do that, you always have to be alert to at least the potential of a conflict of interest. So even if there's no actual conflict of interest, it's always a possibility that that could arise at some point in the future. Because today those people's interests are aligned. They're both on the same side of the case, but it could very easily happen that they wind up on different sides of the case. Before we go on at this point, for those of you listening to the podcast, I'm going to give the first code number. The first code number for today's program is E691. E as in ethics, 691. E691 is the first code number for the podcast program today. Anytime you're representing more than one party in the same case, there's a potential for a conflict of interest. But like I say, even normally that's a perfectly normal thing to do. So if both plaintiffs are injured by the same defendant, it would really be a waste of everybody's resources, and it would add unnecessary expense to have both of those plaintiffs represented by a separate attorney. So it's perfectly appropriate for you to represent both plaintiffs as they sue one defendant. But you have to be mindful of the fact that there could be situations where those interests diverge. And sometimes when you least expect it. And the most extreme example of that I can think of is a case I had a number of years ago where I was representing three plaintiffs who were suing one defendant. And they had exactly the same claim. It was based on the same facts. There was no dispute as to how the money was going to be divided or anything like that. Because what it was I was representing three tenants of an apartment who were the victims of an arsonist. This arsonist came and burned down their apartment building and in the process destroyed all of their personal possessions. And I'm trying to think back to that case because the question that comes up to my mind, and I can't remember the answer to this, was where was the money in that case? But for some reason there was some money. The arsonist had some money. So that's like the most, how could there possibly be a conflict of interest in that case? Because, my three clients, well, they didn't start the fire. This other guy started the fire, and destroyed all of their property, and they were in exactly the same position. They had all their stuff destroyed by this third party. The liability was just absolutely clear because you're not supposed to burn down people's houses. You know, so I mean, it was just the clearest possible case, and you know, I didn't think twice about taking all three of them as my client, and indeed I would do it again. But where the conflict of interest came up in that situation was that, unbeknownst to me, and I think this this came to pass while the case was pending, well, that one of my three plaintiffs turns out had a little criminal matter pending. So one of my three plaintiffs had this criminal case pending. So suddenly I have two you know, just very compelling plaintiffs, but I have this other uncompelling plaintiff who is you know, not going to be a very good witness because this criminal charge is pending against her. And to make matters worse, the victim of the crime was the other two plaintiffs. So totally unrelated to the fire, she was stealing from her roommates, and so it just turned into a big mess. And my all three of my clients must have understood that there was going to be a conflict of interest, because what they tried to do was kind of keep this secret from me. Well, of course, that never works, and I found out about it. So suddenly, I had this case where, you know, I have, you know, this one one client who's not a very credible witness, but two good clients, and also they have this personal conflict going on amongst themselves. So, you know, so at that point, I suddenly had a really bad conflict of interest, and I had to figure out what to do. Later on, we'll find out that there's something called the hot potato doctrine, which says that if you if a conflict of interest does arise midstream, the case holds that you're not supposed to drop one client like a hot potato. Well, that's exactly what I did in that case, and as we'll see when we get to it, there are some exceptions to the hot potato doctrine. So what I did is I dropped one client as a hot potato and kept the other two more lucrative clients. And I, like I say, I think it was appropriate in that case. But any time you do have a joint representation like that, you run the risk of the court applying the hot potato doctrine and saying, well, no, you can't just drop one of your clients. You have to drop all three of them. So so you want to be mindful of those situations, because, you know, that might be the remedy, is that you're just out of the picture entirely, whereas you could have avoided that by not taking the joint representation, you know, by saying, well, there's enough of a potential of a conflict of interest here that I can really only represent one of you. So, like I say, anytime there's a joint representation, you want to have that in the back of your mind, that there is at least a potential conflict of interest. Now, as I mentioned, one situation that can come up in attorney's practice is that, you know, two divorcing spouses walk into your office wanting some advice. Like I say, theoretically, at least in Minnesota, what I could do is draft the joint petition for dissolution of marriage and file it on their behalf. And I guess as long as they consented to it, it would be okay, but still a bad idea, though, because of the possibility of one of them coming along and saying, well, you didn't advise me about what my rights were here. In fact, it might be so severe that I shouldn't take it, you know, that's just so foreseeable that I shouldn't take the case in the first place. So I think most of us would agree we wouldn't do that. Like I say, even attorneys who take the program say, well, no, I would never do that, even though they're not in Iowa. The hypothetical that I can think of, though, where you and I as Minnesota attorneys and Wisconsin attorneys might do that, in fact, even if we don't practice in the area of family law, so it's an area we want to think about, is, well, what about some pro se spouses who are going to be filing a pro se divorce? In Minnesota, and this is probably true in other states as well, but the Minnesota court website has a pretty helpful section for useful advice for pro se litigants, and it provides a lot of information on how to file for things, and they have an extensive section on how to file your pro se divorce. So if you are this divorcing couple, they decide part amicably, and they go to the court website and they download the forms and they fill out the forms, and they take them down to the courthouse and they are divorced, and they've done the whole thing pro se. And there's since they did it pro se, there's no conflict of interest problem for any attorney. It seems to me, though, that where it could pose a problem for some hapless attorney is that what if they have questions during that process about how to fill out those forms? So they download this this 17-page petition that's all written in legalese. They don't understand what some part of it means. So what happens when these two spouses walk into your office, maybe formally, and say, we would like to retain you for 1 hour of your time, and we want you to explain to us what this means here on page 17 of the petition, because we don't understand exactly what that means. So we want you to tell us what that means. Well, as soon as they ask that question, it's a joint representation of both spouses in the same divorce case. So, first of all, it seems to me that the Iowa attorney confronted with that situation would have to say, no, I cannot answer that question because in no event shall I represent both parties in a dissolution of marriage proceeding, which is exactly what you're asking me to do. So I think the Iowa attorney just has to say no. Now, I suppose the Iowa attorney could argue that, well, there's no proceeding pending yet at this point, so I don't know, maybe they could get away with it. But that would be, in Iowa, they're just absolutely precluded from that. In Minnesota or Wisconsin, if the divorcing spouses come into your office and say that, it's still a conflict of interest, and you still need to get that written consent from them. And it still has to be a situation where you can honestly say to yourself that, I think I can still provide them competent advice. But you run a real risk even in that situation because, then what happens when a year later one of the spouses comes back and says, well, I really wanted the silverware, my attorney never advised me that, I had an absolute right to get the silverware because it was non-marital property or something. I think I would do even in that informal situation. I think I would give the advice I would give, in a little bit more formal kind of scenario where they come in to file that joint petition. I would say, well, no, I'm sorry, I don't do joint petitions because it's such a it's so rife with the possibility of a conflict of interest that I would be happy to represent one of you. And that one of you can consent to have the other person here, but if push out comes to shove, I'm only going to be giving advice to one of you. I strongly advise you, the other spouse, to get your own attorney before you sign anything. So I think even in that kind of informal situation where they're ultimately going to be going pro se, I think I would give that same advice. Now, for those of us who don't practice family law on a regular basis, and maybe just some friend, some acquaintance that they know that you're an attorney and they come to you for free legal advice, they ask you, what does this mean here on page 17 of this document that we downloaded from the court website? Even in that situation, you're still an attorney and you're still bound by the rules. And if you're an Iowa attorney in that situation, you have to tell them, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to answer that question because I can't jointly represent both of you. Whereas, in Minnesota, if our personal acquaintances come to us and ask that sort of thing, that might be the situation where I would go ahead and give them the advice. But understanding it's still a conflict of interest, and I still have to get that. I still have to confirm in writing that they consented to it. You, as a Wisconsin attorney, have to get their signature saying that they consented to it. So anytime you have two divorcing spouses, I guess what I'm getting at, even in those most innocuous of situations, Well, it is an area where you have to use a great deal of caution in proceeding. Now, interestingly, kind of the unanticipated consequence of that rule is, especially if you're an Iowa attorney and you just say, "No, I can't deal with this. Go away from me." But even those of us in Minnesota or Wisconsin have to use a little bit more caution in that situation. Well, non-attorneys don't have to use that same caution. So what if these two divorcing spouses don't go to you, their attorney friend? Instead, they go to their social worker, or they go to their clergyman, or they go to their smart friend who's not a lawyer and say, "What does this mean here on this document that I downloaded from the court website?" If you flip to the end of the written materials, you'll see that there's kind of a rule covering that situation. Rule 5.7, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about what Rule 5.7 says, but what Rule 5.7 says that in those situations where somebody is asking their friend, "What does this mean here in the in this court papers that I downloaded?" In most states, depending on exactly what the answer is and depending on exactly what the question is, that probably doesn't amount to the unauthorized practice of law. So just, getting a non-attorney to explain what some document means, that's probably not the unauthorized practice of law, especially if it's kind of an informal situation, if they're just talking to their friend, trying to figure out, what these documents mean. Well, if that non-attorney friend answers that question, the non-attorney friend is asked, "What does this mean on page 17 of this document that I downloaded?" And the friend answers that question, it's probably okay because it's probably not the unauthorized practice of law. And because that person is not an attorney, that person doesn't have to worry about the rules of professional conduct. So that person doesn't have to worry at all about a conflict of interest. So kind of, ironically, if you or I are asked that question, we might not be able to give the answer, even though that layperson is able to give the answer, because we are bound by the rules of professional conduct. We are bound by the rules saying that we have to worry about conflicts of interest. And if you're in Iowa, you're bound by the rules saying that you can never represent both spouses in a dissolution of marriage case. So, like I say, it's kind of an unintended consequence of that rule, saying that, of all the people in the world shut out from giving legal advice in that situation, it's an attorney. So, like I say, your non-attorney friends don't have to worry about that rule, but you do have to worry about it. So, like I say, even though you don't necessarily practice family law on any kind of a regular basis, that's one you want to kind of keep in mind, especially if you're in Iowa, because if you are ever asked to give that informal advice to your friends or acquaintances, it could be a problem. So, like I say, I think the best way to deal with divorce cases is just to say you should never represent both spouses, and I think most attorneys understand that. But there are a few situations where even though those of us who are cautious might have to watch out for it a little bit. So, like I say, that's one area of joint representation. Both spouses in a divorce case you probably want to avoid. And most of the other joint representation cases we'll be talking about are also litigation-type matters. But before we get to the other ones, I do want to point out that even though we're spending a lot of time on litigation kinds of things, you do want to remember that you can have a conflict of interest between two clients involving something other than litigation. So if you have if you have a litigation practice, but you also draft documents and give consulting advice to people, well, those people are obviously still your clients as well. So you have to keep those in mind. And that's why I quoted in the materials here the Widule case, a Minnesota case, a Wisconsin case, just reminding us that you don't, even though we're talking mostly about litigation-type things today, the same rules obviously apply even in situations that do not involve litigation. Another possibly common situation where you have to worry about joint representation and how it can turn into a conflict of interest is if you are representing both the driver and the passenger in an auto accident case. Well, there's a very real risk of a conflict of interest in that situation because obviously, if you are representing both the driver and the passenger who were injured because they were, just driving along, minding their own business, driving, using, extreme caution, just the safest people in the world, and then, out of nowhere, this drunk driver comes careening down the road and smashes into their car. Well, in that case, there's no conflict of interest because, your two plaintiffs have exactly the same claim against the other driver. Either the other driver was negligent or they were not negligent. Unless there could be a conflict of interest because there's not enough money to go around between both of your plaintiffs, but assuming that there's plenty of coverage, then there's not a conflict of interest there, and you can take that case no problem at all, except anytime you have one driver and one passenger, you have the very real possibility that maybe it wasn't totally that other driver's fault. It turns out after doing some discovery in the case that, it wasn't just your guys minding their own business and then this other guy wildly careening down the road. Well, maybe your driver was also a little bit negligent. As soon as that element creeps into the case, then suddenly you have a conflict of interest because your passenger client has, in addition to the claim against the other driver, your passenger client potentially has a claim against your driver client. So you want to be extremely cautious. I wouldn't go so far as to say that you can never represent both the driver and the passenger, but you do have to be mindful of that, that's a very real possibility. And in fact, it's one of those things that's kind of so well settled that I couldn't even find any Minnesota or Wisconsin cases giving us that warning, because I think it looks like most of the attorneys around here are mindful of that and would avoid that in the first place. So the cases that I cite here come from Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. But those cases remind us that it's probably going to be a conflict of interest if you are representing both the driver and the passenger in a personal injury case. Now, at this point, I'm going to give our second code number of the hour. The second code number for today's program is E682. E682 is the second code number. And the next area that we're going to talk about, another area of joint representation where you have to worry about conflicts of interest, and there are more specific rules that we have to follow, is in the criminal context. So can you represent both criminal defendants in a criminal case? And the Cliff's Notes version of the program is no, you can't do it. But we'll explain why. And also, it's not an absolute rule. There are situations where you can represent both criminal co-defendants, but there is a real risk of a conflict of interest for that reason arising out of representing two co-defendants in a criminal case. And it's pointed out best by this Coleman case, a case from Minnesota. And as you can see, the title of that case is In Re Disciplinary Action Against Coleman. So in this case, the Minnesota Supreme Court thought it was such a big deal that they disciplined him in some way. the conflict of interest cases can arise in two contexts. One of them will be in a civil case where one party is trying to disqualify the attorney because of a conflict of interest, but they can also arise in the disciplinary context. And this is a case where the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, this conflict was so obvious, so big of a deal that you should have seen it right away, so therefore we're going to suspend you or whatever they did for engaging in this conflict of interest. Because this this poor lawyer, Mr. Coleman, was representing two co-defendants in a criminal case. And what had happened in this case was that he was representing these two co-defendants who were driving along, and the police officer, for whatever reason, decided to pull them over. And for whatever reason, the police officer decided to search the vehicle. And lo and behold, after doing a search of the vehicle, in the center console of the car, the police officer found, I think it was a weapon. He found a gun in there that those people were not supposed to have. So both of them, both the driver and the passenger, were charged with illegal possession of this gun that was found in the middle of the car. Now, the reason why the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, you should have just walked, you can't represent both of those people, because one very distinct theory of guilt, well, there are a number of theories of guilt that were possible in this case. One of them, now, this has to be one of the reasons, because if you're a prosecutor, you can't just charge two people and hope that one of them is guilty. You have to have probable cause against both of them. So presumably one possible theory of the case was that gun was jointly possessed by both of them. Both of these people, defendant number one and defendant number two, were in possession of that gun, and they were both guilty of illegal possession of the gun. So that's one possibility. They were both jointly possessing it. Another possibility was that they were, neither one of them knew the gun was there. Some third party, put it in there, and they were just both totally innocent. They had absolutely nothing to do with it. So in those two situations, there's no conflict of interest, no problem at all. But the more likely scenario, or a likely scenario, is that one of the defendants is going to say, it wasn't my gun. I was just the passenger. My friend gave me a ride. I got in his car. I had no idea that there was a gun in the center console. It's all his fault. Well, at that point, he's pointing the finger. You have one client, defendant number two, the passenger, who is also going to be the star prosecution witness, saying it was not my gun, it was his gun. So you have a pretty severe conflict of interest. Or alternatively, the driver could be the one in that position, saying I was just driving along, minding my own business, giving my friend a ride, and unbeknownst to me, he must have slipped this gun into the center console. It's all his fault. So in those situations, you have an obvious conflict of interest, and it was so obvious that the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, you shouldn't have taken the case in the first place, because it was just too much of a potential conflict of interest. Just checking my notes here. There's enough of potential conflict of interest that the Minnesota Supreme Court said you shouldn't have taken it. Even in cases, though, where there's not that possibility of one co-defendant pointing the finger at the other one and saying, I am innocent, the other guy is guilty, even in other situations, though, there's a huge probability of that arising. Because let's say we take the hypothetical of two guys going in and holding up the 7-Eleven, somehow the facts are either they're both guilty or they're both innocent. They both had an alibi that they were with the other one, so they're going to either they're both guilty or they're both innocent. Well, then, from a theoretical point of view, there's really no conflict of interest. as the case begins. But even there, there's a strong possibility of a conflict of interest, because what happens when the prosecutor calls up and says, "Well, it looks like I don't have too strong of a case against either one of you, so I tell you what, I'll make a deal. The first one of you to come in and plead guilty and agree to testify against your co-defendant, I will give you a very sweet deal. You know, you'll get off with probation, and we'll throw the book at your co-defendant. And they're both equally guilty. The prosecutor doesn't care which one he gets, just which one of you is first." Well, in that situation, then you obviously have a very severe conflict of interest, because especially if you were the attorney getting that phone call saying, send one of your clients down to testify against the other client, how do you advise your clients then? If you are, on the other hand, if you are representing just one defendant and you get that phone call, then your course of action is clear. You tell your client, go down there as fast as possible and take this deal, because then you'll get off with probation, whereas this other guy, who I don't have to worry about because he's not my client, he's going to get sent to prison for a long time, but that's not my problem. So that's why the courts are very, very reluctant to allow one attorney to represent two co-defendants in the same criminal case, even if the theory of guilt means that they're either both guilty or both innocent. The reason why the courts are so worried about that one is because we have a Sixth Amendment that says criminal defendants in criminal cases are entitled to effective assistance of counsel. And in these Supreme Court cases that I've cited here, the Supreme Court said that that really means that co-defendants have the right to have an attorney who is not burdened by a conflict of interest. So the Holloway and Kyler cases say that rule is of constitutional dimension. So therefore, the courts are pretty picky about when they will let one attorney represent two defendants. And in Minnesota, that's codified in Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 17.03, which I have quoted in the materials. Now, even if you are in a state other than Minnesota, it's still instructive to look at this Minnesota Rule 17.03, because this rule more or less just codifies those Supreme Court cases. So even if your state, if these procedures are written into the rules, well, they're probably going to be using pretty similar language. But even if it's not codified in your state rules of criminal procedure, the court will follow more or less the same procedure, because this is just a restatement of those Supreme Court cases. This kind of conflict of interest can be consented to, like any conflict of interest, but the court is going to be very careful to make sure that consent is knowing. So this Minnesota Rule 17.03, or the comparable version in some other state, provides that any time two defendants show up in court represented by the same attorney, the trial judge has a duty to go through a very specific procedure to make sure that that conflict of interest is knowingly and intelligently consented to. So anytime two defendants are jointly charged and jointly represented by the same defendant, the following procedure must be followed before plea and trial. The trial judge must address each defendant personally on the record. So we have to have a little aside where the judge is addressing the defendant personally. So Mr. Defendant 1, Mr. Defendant 2, I have some things to tell you. I have to tell you that I have to advise you that there are potential dangers to dual representation, and I have to explain what those potential dangers are. So the trial court has to explain that, there's a possibility that one of you will be asked to plead guilty and get a really good deal in exchange for testifying against your co-defendant, at which point your attorney will be in a very difficult position and will not really be able to give you full advice. The trial judge has to give each defendant an opportunity to ask questions about the complexities or possible consequences of dual representation. So the judge has to engage in this colloquy with the defendant. And then, if that was not bad enough, because I don't know if the judge is going to be willing to do that, because, you know, if the judge just says, no, you can't have joint representation, well, there's probably very little likelihood that that will be reversed. On the other hand, if the judge says something wrong during this colloquy, well, then it's just setting up a reversal. But the real deal breaker is the following, because the court must elicit from each defendant in a narrative statement. So the judge at this point has to stop asking yes or no questions, because, like a plea colloquy, when someone pleads guilty, it's normally this inarticulate defendant standing there being questioned by either the court or by an attorney saying, do you understand you have the right to a trial? Yes. Do you understand that you have the right to call witnesses? Yes. And they just, go through this list of yes or no questions. But here, the defendant has to say the following in narrative form. It says, yes, judge, I have been advised of my right to effective representation. Yes, judge, I understand the details of defense counsel's possible conflict of interest, and I understand the perils of that conflict. I've talked about this with my attorney. In fact, if I wanted to, I have the opportunity to talk to an outside attorney. And, judge, I hereby voluntarily waive my constitutional right to separate counsel. Well, the defendant has to say all of that in narrative form. It can't just be leading questions that they ask, answer yes or no. And, most criminal defendants are not they got into a life of crime partly because they were not necessarily the most articulate people in the world. So, so in most criminal cases, I think the Cliff's Notes version of this portion of the program is simply that, no, you can't do it. You can't have joint representation in criminal cases. Although there could be some situations where you could represent two defendants, but it's a pretty burdensome proceeding under this Minnesota Rule 17.03 or the equivalent in other states, which is going to be very similar. At this point, with about 5 minutes left, I'm going to give our another code number. That is E691. E691. E691 is the third code number for this portion of the program. And let's see, we have I have to check our start time here. Yeah, we have about. We have about 10 minutes left, or a little bit less than that, so we'll, I'm just wondering if I should take them a little bit out of order. No, I guess we'll just go ahead in the order that it's presented here, and I'll squeeze this into the next 10 minutes. Representation of insured and insurer. In fact, that's about the right time to talk about this subject. As we will actually learn probably in part two or three of the program, the rule, there are special rules governing you when you are an insurance defense attorney, because you are getting paid by the insurance company. However, Rule 1.8, when we get to that, makes very clear that even though the insurance company happens to be paying your bills, your client is still nonetheless the client. Your client is the insured. Just because you're getting these checks from the insurance company paying your fee does not mean that the insurance company has any special say in the case. And that's very clear. And if you're an insurance defense attorney, certainly you understand that. The mere fact that you are getting paid by the insurance company does not mean that they are your client. Your client is still clearly your client. That's clear. Everybody knows that. Certainly you know that if you're an insurance defense attorney. What some states, though, take that to a further extreme. Now, Minnesota is definitely not one of them, and Iowa is, and Iowa and Wisconsin are not one of them either. As far as I can tell, the only states where the following rule apply is Arkansas, Connecticut, and Montana. But keep it in mind, if you're an insurance defense attorney and if you ever have cases that come up in Arkansas, Connecticut, or Montana, well, then the following rule might apply. Like I say, in this Pine Island and Shelby case from Minnesota, Minnesota makes clear that that is not the rule, because it says that in Minnesota, defense counsel has an attorney-client relationship with the insured. We all knew that. But you do not necessarily, because of that, also have an attorney-client relationship with the insurance company. Those other three states, though, carry it a step further and say that if you are an insurance defense attorney in Arkansas, Connecticut, or Montana, and you are representing the insured, the person who's getting sued because of the thing that they're that the insurance policy covers, in those states, you are precluded from forming a separate attorney-client relationship with the insurance company, which, like I say, is not the rule in this state. But if you ever have a multi-state kind of practice where, you know, some other state's rules might apply, you do have to keep that in mind because, well, you might have an attorney-client relationship with the insurance company, you know, in some, in a Wisconsin, you know, in an unrelated Wisconsin case, and then you you're called upon to defend this this Montana case. Well, maybe you can't take that Montana case because of that unrelated attorney-client relationship that you have with the insurance company. So keep that in mind if you are an insurance defense attorney. That if you ever branch out to take cases in some of those states with that more strict rule, well, your practice at home might preclude being able to do that, and it's one area that you want to watch out for. But in general, you know, like I say, the rule is that just because somebody else is paying your bill, like the insurance company, that does not make them your client. Let's see. I will flip ahead slightly here to because we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'll just flip here to the topic heading in my written materials called closely related entities, and we'll just wind up with that. And this is another one of those kind of common sense principles that well, we all know this, but I guess we should just be reminded of it. That if, you know, the conflict of interest depends on who your client is, obviously. So if you have a conflict of interest and you cannot take cases against the Acme Widget Company because they're your client in some other matter, well, the courts are going to look at the kind of the practical application of that. So if you have a conflict of interest against the Acme Widget Company, well, then you probably also have a conflict of interest against, you know, Acme Widgets of Canada Limited, their wholly owned subsidiary. So even though you might be able to you know, put together a legal argument saying that no, this other entity is not my client because it's a totally separate corporation, well, this disco trade case from the Southern District of New York makes clear that the courts are not going to pay a lot of attention to you know, kind of an obtuse legal argument saying that this is really a separate company. They're really going to look at the practical application of who exactly your client is. So don't. In fact, we'll see that in a few other places when deciding these conflicts of interest cases, the courts will, you know, a lot of times take a very practical view. So you're probably not going to get too successful making these arcane legal arguments. So anyway, that brings us up to the end of our first hour. And just let me get my control panel here. Yeah, that brings us up to the end of our first hour. When we pick up tomorrow in part two of the program, we'll talk about the situation of that in-house attorney who only has one client, what kind of conflicts of interest situations might arise by virtue of the fact that that you're also giving advice to individuals within the company, such as officers and employees. And before we conclude here, I'm just going to unmute the line. Questions. Yeah, so if we have any questions from our live participants today, you can go ahead and ask now. I should point out that if you're listening on the podcast and if you do have any questions about anything we covered, you can email those to me at clem.law@usa.net, and I'll answer in the time specified by the rules, which is usually, I think, 24 hours. But are there any live questions today? Well, hearing none, I thank you for joining us, I will end the recording at this time, and then we'll pick up with part two of the program tomorrow or in the next segment of the podcast. So thanks for joining us. If you have questions, you can find the answers or my contact information anyway on my website, richardclem.com. Thanks for joining us.